court will proceed to the second case of the day, Bishel versus Stone Bank School. Mr. Fishbach.
May it please the court, my name is Nathan Fishbach. I represent the Stone Bank School Board and the individual school board members in this matter. This case comes before the court on an appeal of decision granting summary judgment to the plaintiff and against the school district and the school board members. The case centers upon a superintendent towards the end of a two-year contract and whether or not the superintendent should or should not have been renewed. It does not focus upon the termination of that superintendent during that two-year contract. As a part of the renewal process, the school board conducted a 12-hour hearing before deciding to not renew the contract. The superintendent, the plaintiff in this case, has claimed that four of the five school board members had prior disagreements with the school board and were so biased that they could not sit. The lower court granted the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on the issue of bias in plaintiff's favor, denied the defendant's motion for summary judgment, including the individual defendant's motion for summary judgment based on qualified immunity. We submit that the district court erred in finding that the school board members possessed such bias that they could not sit at the non-renewal hearing. I think it's important in reviewing this issue to put the issue into context. Stone Bank is a small school with 315 families located in Waukesha, Wisconsin. A 12-hour renewal hearing was held. The plaintiff superintendent called 14 witnesses. The plaintiff called all the school board members. 41 items of evidence were introduced, over 400 pages of testimony.
Two of the board members who voted against the renewal, two of the four, were on the board when she was hired.
That's correct.
When she was hired, was there a unanimous vote of the board to hire her?
I think it was, Your Honor.
The record, I don't know if that's anywhere in the record.
I am not sure if that's in the record. I think it was, though. I could supplement to determine that. Okay. During the hearing, and there was no witnesses were excluded from the hearing, no evidence, to my knowledge, was excluded. During the hearing, three of the school board members acknowledged upon questioning that they had been attacked or questioned by the plaintiff in some limited aspect of their work months earlier on certain limited issues. These issues occurred over a 5 months to a year period, one related to a blindsiding on an all-day kindergarten, another related to some interaction with the staff, a third related to some bills that were submitted. They answered the magic word yes, and as a result of that, it was found that there was bias. I would suggest to the court that by looking at the overall hearing, that there was no evidence that these board members were biased in came with anything but an open mind at this hearing. At the start of the hearing, they were instructed that they should come with an open mind. They should make their decision solely on what happened here. There was no question. During the hearing, they were all questioned during the hearing. There was no question as to whether these three school board members who are here today, whether they, in fact, had an open mind. There was no inquiry as to that issue. The hearing itself showed that they were trying to render a fair result in terms of length, number of people they had, number of witnesses.
Could I explore one thing?
Yes.
The board decided not to renew sometime before February 1st, is it?
That's correct.
Yeah. Couldn't they have just said, you're fired, and that's it?
In order to be fired, they would have to be fired for cause.
There's no way at any point, even, what about, I shouldn't say that, you're not renewed. I didn't mean to say fired. You're not renewed, period.
They could, under the statute, they had 4 months, there was a provision for 5 months where they have to give consideration of non-renewal, and then you have a non-renewal hearing. And then you have 4 months to decide. You have to give notice of whether you're renewing or not.
So there's no way to not renew without going through this process?
That's correct. That's correct. You need to go through this process in order to not renew.
And it's always been contemplated that the board is got the one that's got to go through this process.
That's correct. And under the Hortonville case, the U.S. Supreme Court case talking about Wisconsin law, it talks about the importance of the school board as the elected officials of the jurisdiction to make decisions about the administrator. And probably the most important decision that a school board makes is on who they hire, who they fire, who they keep, and who they don't keep as superintendent.
Oh, I understand that. That's why I wondered why, they couldn't, without a hearing, have said that not renewed her contract.
That's correct.
So we're getting into this morass, I guess, of now who's biased and due process and all these other things. There's no way to avoid that, apparently, or could have been avoided.
Well, there would have to be some sort of pre-termination hearing.
Well, what if everybody on the board is predisposed and say this, that I don't care about the facts of this case, just say this woman is clearly incompetent and there's no way, we cannot renew it. We got to go through the process, but we can't renew it. Isn't everyone on that board then biased?
Well, that's the issue in terms of what constitutes an impermissible level of bias. In terms of a particularly small school district, there is constant interaction between the school board and the superintendent. What she's entitled to is receive notice of what the issues are. She's entitled to an explanation of them, and she's entitled to present her side of the story. And the school board should come to that with an open mind to listen to what her side of the story is.
Well, open mind, but we know what we're going to do.
Well, I think the case law is pretty clear that an adjudicator, such as a school board here, can have prior familiarity with the facts in the case, and to have prior familiarity. In any type of setting like this, there's going to be prior familiarity, particularly in a small school district. And so,
are these people elected, for example?
They're all elected officials.
So they can get pitched by the voters.
That's correct.
But I guess the dilemma I see is we go through this due process analysis, and if you apply the strict letter of that process, you should have an objective forum. It's like judges, we have to recuse where we have some predetermined result, or we have some sort of conflict. Where are we applying that same standard to a school board to say, well, you got a fight with her and somebody called her a liar or she called you a liar or something like that, so you have an obvious adversary relationship that I don't care if it's what they tell them, there's at least this perception of bias. Is that the standard that is being applied here?
I think the standard that should be in the Bacalus case, what they stated, what the Seventh Circuit stated, was that the level of controversy has to be so deep that there is no way that that these officials could make the decision.
It is pretty much a subjective analysis, then, and we got to go through this and look at this and say, well, gee, that wasn't so bad, or gosh, I don't know how that person could be objective.
That's correct, Your Honor. In the Bacalus case, and the cases that were in the Bacalus case, all those cases involving board members were clear evidence of prejudging, where they offered the school official a severance package, in one of the cases they campaigned against that school official, the superintendent campaigned that person should be removed. We have none of that here, and there's absolutely no evidence in this case that there was prejudging on the issue of whether there should or should not be renewal. And there was no evidence that they did not keep an open mind. In the Bacalus case and the other cases cited in the Bacalus were related to the U.S. Supreme Court, where there's an ongoing discussion between a judge and the person on trial, where it was just clear that there was animosity between them. That's not present in this case. I think you have to look at the specific facts in the case to determine whether or not there was such a level of bias. And I think in this case, the problem is that they answered candidly the magic words, and then they said, well, it's bias. And I think that the problem here is that if the level of bias is so low that it becomes constitutionally impermissible, or I shouldn't say bias, but that they've had a prior contact regarding an issue, that if it's impermissibly low, that in essence the school board will have to be pushed to relinquish its responsibilities. And probably there's no more important point that a school board could make than judging the renewal or non-renewal of a superintendent.
Well, what was the alternative forum? Had these people all had this premeditated idea what should happen, or most of them.
Well, that's the problem, Your Honor. The statute does not say that there is an alternative form. And the unique situation in this case is this. If one person had to recuse himself, such as a judge in say, in Chicago or Milwaukee, if one judge had to recuse himself, they could then go be substituted and go to another judge. Here, they're asking for four of the five school board members to recuse themselves. What are they supposed to do in that case? Would one school board member make the decision? There's no guidance in the statute, and there's no guidance in the case law. And so, in order for, I would suggest to the court that if, given the level of bias and given that issue, that the school board acted appropriately in evaluating the case. I think the issue that comes about is if you lower the bar too low, then you won't have school boards deciding the most important issue that confronts them. There were other issues relating to bias in this case, which the court did not go into. I would suggest that they are not issues that mandate that they were the plaintiff received a biased fact panel here. One related to whether the attorney, what his role in the case was. I would suggest to the court that the prior case law of the Seventh Circuit permits an attorney to sort of facilitate the issue. And the attorney in this case, Mr. Berthelsen, facilitated the matter. He did not block any evidence, did not make evidentiary decisions, did not participate in the deliberations, did not curtail any witnesses. I would suggest that his role was appropriate.
I assume he's the attorney for the board, is that right?
That's correct.
And he sits in on all the meetings. This is a sort of a typical agency attorney that goes to meetings, and he's the guy that makes the rulings and things like that.
Well, in this hearing, he did not make the rulings.
I know, I mean, but there's always question of law. Whatever an attorney does, like a city attorney or a drainage board attorney, all these people, they sit there and sort of give the legal expertise. But he did this throughout.
He did this during the hearing.
Well, I know, but he's not brought in as a special lawyer. He's the lawyer that's there at all the meetings.
That's correct, Your Honor. And importantly, he did not curtail any of the deliberations in this matter, did not participate in any of the deliberations in this matter. The other issue, which another part of the due process analysis, is whether this plaintiff has a constitutionally protected property interest. Again, this is not a termination hearing. This is a non-renewal hearing. In order to determine whether or not she had a protected constitutional interest, must look at the underlying documents, which would be the contract, the statute, possibly the policy. The agreement here provides for a two-year term. She did not have a protected interest in an additional two-year term. And this case law, which talks about how the procedures themselves of the statute do not provide a protected property right to an additional term. In the response brief that the plaintiff filed here, the superintendent filed, they're claiming that she received a protected property interest in an additional two-year term because of the lack of notice. And I would suggest that she received the proper notice for consideration of non-renewal, which was 5 months, and she received the proper notice for non-renewal, which was 4 months. And under those notice provisions, since they were met, she did not have a protected property interest in an additional two-year term of the contract.
Well, that gets back to my original inquiry about this five-month thing. If she had gotten some kind of a notice before that, like we're probably not going to renew you or something, is that enough to erase any possible property right?
If she had received, as she did, if she had received any time during her, if she received 5 months before, at least 5 months before, a notice that she was not, that consideration was given to not renewing, then would trigger the process. And so during that time, that would be sufficient, yes.
Okay, so that didn't happen because of certain delays?
Well, she did receive a notice within the five-month period that they were considering non-renewal.
And you think that's enough to eliminate a property right?
Well, as long as, and then you have, right, I mean, the only time you would have the property right interest problem for the additional two-year term would be if they didn't follow the appropriate notice provisions. And here they did follow notice provisions.
Well, that may be true, but does it make any difference if you satisfy federal due process requirements, whether or not you complied with every dotting the I's and crossing the T's of some state law requirements regarding notice?
No, Your Honor. I would agree. You don't have to. If you satisfy federal due process, you don't have to satisfy every part of a state statute. Federal due process is an evolving standard, and in a case like this, a pre-termination hearing, what's required is she receives notice. She receives an indication of what the claims are, and she receives an opportunity to talk.
And she, I mean, otherwise, somebody here could just completely go off the deep end, and after this 5-month period under state law, and the board decides to take some adverse action to her, and might comply with due process, federal due process, that wouldn't raise any concerns, would it?
No, it would not. The issue is on the federal due process, whether they complied with provided federal due process, and they certainly did. My only point on the protected interest is that they weren't required to do that under the protected property interest issue. And the final point I would like to raise is relating to the qualified immunity claims. I would suggest to the court that the law is not so developed that a reasonable school board member would have known that they should have recused themselves, particularly in light of the facts and circumstances of this case, where the recusal request was for 4 out of the 5 school board members. There's no guidance in the law or the case law as to what they should do in that circumstance under this statute. And I would suggest to the court that given the minimal level of conflict between the school board and the superintendent, and given the statutory framework and the case law framework, that they did not, they acted as reasonable board members would do in this circumstance. They endeavored to provide her with a fair hearing, and they did not attempt to block a fair hearing. I would suggest there's evidence that they, the presumption that they acted with integrity and honesty in deciding this issue. And I reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Fishback. Mr. Westerhoff?
Good morning, Your Honors. There are 3 reasons why the school board members should not receive qualified immunity in this case. First, they did not provide a fair and impartial hearing to Dr. Beuschel. Second, they deprived her of property. And third, they deprived her of liberty.
I'm troubled by this whole idea that because there's this dispute between the board and the plaintiff here, that the board is required to abdicate its adjudicatory responsibilities here and give it to somebody else. You say an independent adjudicator should have been appointed, and I guess Judge Mannion asked a question sort of relating to that earlier. How would this hearing have run if you think this was improper?
There were a number of options, I believe, that would have been acceptable. I believe that the duty that the school board had was not a non-delegable duty, and they could have assigned the task to somebody else.
Well, isn't that the most important thing that a school board does, is hire the person who's going to be, in this case, the district superintendent and the principal of the only school in the district? It probably isn't anything more important than that, and the board is elected to discharge that responsibility. She didn't apparently have the trust and confidence of the majority of the board members and lost her job. Under your theory, it would seem to me that the board has to take a seat on the bench here and let somebody else come in and decide if this person is going to run the district for another 2 years.
That could be possible, yes. In fact, in this case, it is possible. That is a practice that is done in Wisconsin. Brooks Heathman submitted an affidavit describing that he's done it. And what is done can be a decision. They can make a decision, make a recommendation to the board sometimes.
How does that work, though, Mr. Westerhoff? Suppose the board, following your plan, were to pick an independent adjudicator. And there's a challenge to that individual by the person who's seeking the hearing, or entitled to the hearing, suggesting that the very act of the picking of X carries with it a bias. In other words, that you know, when you recuse yourself as a judge, you don't pick the successor.
And I believe there are cases on that point where the party does not necessarily have a right. The party in Dr. Beischel's position doesn't have a right to decide who the decision maker should be. In this case, Hortonville, I think, is instructive. In Hortonville, the United States Supreme Court stated that a school board can lose what it called its unremarkable power when due process requires. And in this case also, Wisconsin statutes, I believe, contemplated a situation like this in 118.001, where it describes that the board's statutory power does not conflict, it applies unless it conflicts with state or federal law. And in this case, we have the United States Constitution and the Wisconsin Constitution, and those would trump the Wisconsin statute 118.24. There are a number of cases in which school boards have been recused, including all the members of the school board. In the Wisconsin case of Harkness, it dealt with the comparable non-renewal statute dealing with teachers, 118.22. And in that case, the court described that the non-renewal procedures are very important in Wisconsin, that it's for thoughtful and meaningful decision-making. They're not supposed to be pro forma in nature. And in that case, a school board member had issues with the manner in which a teacher dealt with disciplining the school board member's son. And the court agreed that that board member perhaps should not sit on the board because of the bias, and proceeded with a jury issue on that issue.
Why do you think there's such a serious problem here that would otherwise override the presumption that the board can set aside any of these prior disagreements with the superintendent and rule fairly on whether she should be renewed or two?
There are a number of reasons for that. And it's important as background to remember that an impartial decision maker is at the heart of due process. It's been called a minimal rudiment of due process. It's so important that it's not even necessary to prove actual bias, but even a probability of bias.
And in this case, there are... Here, a few months before this whole thing came to a head, the board voted to give her the maximum salary increase under Wisconsin law, isn't it? What seems to me, that's pretty strong evidence of the board, at least at that time, not being biased.
Let me specifically describe what made them biased, such that they could not sit, and in fact that they should not receive qualified immunity. First, they were the only witnesses against Dr. Beischel. Dr. Beischel had 14 witnesses on her side, as well as her own testimony. And the testimony from Dr. Beischel and the other witnesses responded to the reasons propounded by the school board. The only evidence on the other side was the testimony from the school board members. So the school board members were left to weigh, who do we believe? What testimony do we find credible? And they decided that they believed their own testimony. In that situation, there is no appearance of impartiality, and the probability of bias is far too great. The Stallworth case describes that when a witness is also the judge, it clearly offends the most basic notions of due process.
Well, the witness became a judge because, or the judge became a witness through her choice that she wanted to examine the board members under oath.
There was no testimony proffered by the district whatsoever other than the opportunity for us to question the board members. That was the only testimony. They presented not a single witness except for their own testimony. I've never seen that done and never read
it. A detailed series of claims of how she wasn't measuring up to their...
Exactly, and the only evidence that supported those claims was their own belief and their own testimony.
Sure. I mean, they might be... could be a totally unreasonable board. Interesting that one of the board members homeschooled her own children, which is sort of unusual, I think, to be a member of a public school board and do that. But this board could be totally unreasonable in that way and how they were doing their job. But this isn't a termination case. This is a non-renewal. And that's a big difference here, isn't it?
It is a big difference in that the standard for discharge is just cause. And in this case, the standard is described in the statute governing non-renewal, where the board had to have reasons and needed to provide the reasons.
Why do we care about that statute in viewing what's required under federal due process?
That statute comes into play, I think, more on the protected property interest because the school board did not give the required notice for consideration for the required notice of a non-renewal decision.
What do you mean they didn't give it? They gave it. You mean they didn't do it timely?
Correct. Their school board policy required 5 months notice of a non-renewal decision. And in this case, they did not give 5 months notice of the non-renewal decision. The school board policy is more generous to Dr. Beischel than the statute. The statute requires 5 months notice of consideration of non-renewal and 4 months notice of the non-renewal decision. The school board policy required 5 months notice of the non-renewal decision. And in this case, the board did not follow its own policy in giving 5 months notice of its non-renewal decision.
Well, they blame that on the court's injunction, didn't they?
Right. They blame that on that. The state court described that they could have given 7 months notice. And they chose to wait until 4 business days before the hearing in order to provide notice. There was no limit on the amount. And Dr. Beischel wasn't required to waive her rights under school board policies in order to receive due process. That was addressed by the state court.
I thought that the request of the board was only that you're not going to argue this notice thing if we adjourn this hearing for a month or so to give you more time.
Right, and we did not waive our right to both due process and the policy, and the state court agreed that we didn't need to waive that. The second reason why the school board was unconstitutionally biased or had the appearance of bias is because they were the targets of personal abuse or criticism from Dr. Beischel. The reasons that they gave, the initial reasons that they gave for consideration for non-renewal described in their own words that they felt personally attacked by Dr. Beischel. This wasn't something that just came out during the questioning at the non-renewal hearing. They did testify, however, during the non-renewal hearing under oath that they did feel personally attacked, and they reached findings of fact that they felt personally attacked. This is the type of situation that's described in the law as grounds ipso facto for disqualification.
But the problem with that is that someone who then is the target of a non-renewal can disqualify the elected school board by attacking it.
No, that is not the case. The case of New York State inspection describes the situation, I believe, is instructive in that regard, where it describes it's not a question whether someone is provocative. It's whether the person is provoked. Dr. Beischel could say things that were provocative, but if the school board members were not provoked, there wouldn't be grounds for bias. In this case, there is very clear evidence that they were provoked because they described on their own that they were provoked. The issues are worth reflecting upon, too, why they felt that they were personally attacked. Board Member Lentz complained because Dr. Beischel addressed an issue to the school board about Ms. Lentz, who is a school board member, interfering with teachers' ability to prepare and disciplining students at school, and that wasn't a proper role for a school board member. Ms. Lentz said that she felt personally attacked by that when Dr. Beischel was just trying to address a legitimate issue. Ms. Mouchet felt personally attacked about an ethics issue, about her ordering textbooks when she was homeschooling her children. Dr. Beischel appropriately addressed that issue to the school board president, explained the concern, but Ms. Mouchet described that she felt personally attacked by that. Ms. Cosimata testified that she felt personally attacked and blindsided by something that Dr. Beischel had done. The Bacalus case that Attorney Fishback refers to described that where there is an accusation that a board member is unethical, there is a valid claim that the person may not have the necessary partiality in order to sit in that decision. And it's also important to remember the context. The one board member who was not the source of the reasons for consideration for non-renewal voted against non-renewal. And he believed that it was a sad day in the district that she was being non-renewed. It's also important to remember what the school board issued these long list of facts and the allegation. Well, their findings of fact at the end of the hearing were just the mirror image of their initial reasons. There was no winnowing, insisting, there was no analysis other than we believe that these reasons are valid and therefore at the end were valid. We're not listening to anybody else's testimony. This is our conclusion. This is akin to the case in Monahan where the court described that a school board, it needed to go through a hearing process. It knew it needed to go through a hearing process, so it went through the hearing process just so that it could say it did. That's not what is contemplated by due process, and it's not what's contemplated by Wisconsin statutes either. Attorney Fishback stated that there was no evidence that the board prejudged the case. That is not accurate. The school board issued a statement before the hearing stating, we think you will see our reasons were reasonable and well substantiated. That was what they said before they heard any evidence at all.
Well, how about in a judicial context when a judge denies a motion to suppress a confession of a defendant? Is that judge then obligated to step aside because he knows the defendant admitted the criminal activity?
I wouldn't believe so, Your Honor, and particularly I would assume that a jury would ultimately decide the guilt or innocence of the person. But I don't practice criminal law, so I can't get into that in too much detail. But I don't believe so, and also judges are trained in how to deal with issues such as that, whereas the school board member in this case described on their own that they were personally attacked, they were the only, provided the only evidence against it, and decided that they believed their own testimony.
Well, over personally attacked, are you suggesting that's stronger, Mr. Westerhoff, than saying, I feel I was criticized?
Yes. The case of...
I mean, say you'd used the word, I felt criticized, it would have been okay, but because personal attack ratchets it up a little bit, or breaks it?
Well, I believe it does ratchet it up, but whether criticized would be enough, I think you'd need a little bit more information. The case would describe whether the issue is whether or not the board member had personal feelings or felt personal stings.
Well, I guess I'm just concerned, you know, down the road on where we go in this. Suppose we have a relatively small school board in a relatively small community, and the question of renewal comes up, and now we have two of the five members of the board. We're not hiring members. So they came on at post the hiring of an individual. Should they say to the three who hired that you ought not to be in the renewal because you bring the bias of belief to reaffirm your position, you know, if suggesting that there's likelihood of momentum to renew because you made the initial hire? Should you say, no, it just should be the two of us who have been subsequent to the hiring who are now elected to the board, that we really should be the fair arbiters? What about an argument like that? Would that follow, maybe, where we're going?
I don't believe so at all. I don't believe there would be any case law to support that. The fact that someone hired someone at an earlier date does not create any bias, I believe, at all. And particularly where there is a presumption of a lack of bias. In this case, there is so much evidence that overcomes the presumption of a lack of partiality that very much distinguishes that case from this one. The personal stings, that is the question, I believe, that whether the person had personal feelings, whether they felt personally stung.
Does it have to do with the number of the members? If we had a 12-person board here and four, would you say we'd have a different case? Or is the board decision contaminated just because there's a significant membership of a board that has there's a concern of fairness?
There are a number of cases that describe that if one board member is biased, that does contaminate the process. But if there were, say, a 12-member board and four members were biased, I believe the four could be recused and the remaining eight could consider the issue.
Should we look at this at all in terms of, like, the way the Supreme Court sometimes faces the rule of necessity? You know, you've got to decide it because we're the only board in town, we're the only court in town.
The rule of necessity has never been argued by defendants. That's not an issue that's been briefed or, frankly, thoroughly researched.
I should just put that thought aside. Sorry I brought it up. No.
In this case, there is, the cases do describe where entire school boards were required to be recused. State Tenure Commission. The cited to the court a case where all the members of the Supreme Court recused themselves. As described in Hortonville, the school board has an unremarkable power given to it by the legislature that due process can require the board be relieved of. It's also important that to remember that the school superintendent is not a private employee, and the school board is not a private employer, where the superintendent is an employee at will. The superintendent, in the public interest, should remain the superintendent as long as she's doing a good job. And if the school board can't support its reason...
No, that's not necessarily true. I mean, that's why you're hired for a term. If the board has no bias at all against her, just doesn't like her, just thinks somebody else would do a better job. That's the difference between termination and non-renewal.
Well, yes and no. There is a very big difference between termination and non-renewal in that termination, discharge, requires just cause. Non-renewal still requires a reason. The legislature described you have to have reasons, and that reason
but
you have a right to a hearing.
Again, goes to state law, and my questions have been focusing on what's required under federal due process requirements.
I agree, Your Honor, that under federal due process requirements, there, under federal due process, you wouldn't have that's a different question. Under the state statute, there is a requirement of reasons. But in this case, the district did deprive her of property protected by the United States Constitution because they did not give her the required notice required by policy 2001.5.
If a school board, hypothetically, said this person is coming up for renewal, she's does some good things, but I think we can really do better, and we all agree we can do better, so we're not going to renew her. Does that board have to disqualify itself then from if the person requests a hearing on that renewal?
If that board has reached a conclusion where it's prejudged the outcome of the hearing, then they...
Oh, come on, that's so silly. I mean, obviously, if they decide that they want to have a non-renewal, they've made a tentative decision that person ought to be non-renewed, but then they're going to give you a hearing, and maybe something will develop there that will change your mind. I think it just seems so divorced from reality here, that this whole situation.
I see my time is a main response. The procedural due process requirements required in this case apply because of the protected property and liberty interest, and the state statute also comes into play. A school board does not have a right to remove an employee for no reason at all. It's not an employee at will.
This isn't a termination. This is a non-renewal.
Right, and under the state statute, which still needs to be considered, because the state did establish a procedure under which the only procedure by which an administrator can be non-renewed, and under that procedure, there has to be reasons. They have to provide the reasons. There has to be a hearing, and under Hartnett, that needs to be a meaningful process, not pro forma and not a sham. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Westerhoff. Mr. Fishback.
In my remaining time, I would like to address a number of points. First, regarding what's the appropriate notice under the state statute. This plaintiff received notice that there was consideration of non-renewal on January 14th, which was clearly within the five-month period, and was notified of renewal, non-renewal on February 24th, which was in the four-month period. There was an issue raised as whether the contract or the policy applies or controls. And under the contract, it specifically states that if there's a conflict between the contract and the policy, the contract shall control. And the contract specifically focuses on the state statute. Second point, there was a question raised a few moments ago regarding a criminal trial. In a criminal trial, a judge can rule on a suppression issue and then sit as a fact finder during that criminal trial if there is no jury. And so the fact that a judge before the trial might have formed impressions relating to suppression would not necessarily make that judge be recused from hearing that case. Third, there was an issue raised as to the actual non-renewal hearing as to how the words attack and, you know, criticize came about. In fact, at least with two of the witnesses, there was a question by plaintiff's counsel which said, and you feel Dr. Beischel personally attacked you? The answer, yes. In other words, the words were supplied by the plaintiff's counsel during the hearing, and using those magic words now as the basis for this claim. And the fourth thing I want to mention is that there was no obligation on the school board to present any witnesses during the hearing. All they required to do was have the plaintiff provide, you know, her day in court, her story as to what happened. And five, I would again reiterate what we stated regarding there was no property interest in a non-renewal. No property interest in a continuation of the two-year contract. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Fishback. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.